Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. This is our next panel for Ruckus, Redefining People Leadership. We're really excited to be here and get going. I'm going to pass this off to our CEO, Anish, and he will introduce himself.
So my name's Anish. My background was helping to lead marketing for different companies, both full-time as a consultant, grew up in the Bay Area, and moved to New York about 4 years ago. And then I began recruiting for a variety of different companies and then building up an executive search firm. So now we're a team of 16, kind of internationally based, and recruiting executive level roles for a lot of kind of interesting organizations that are fast growing.
Hi, everyone. I am Cassidy Gonzalez, and I am the VP of People at Pura. We've been at Pura for just almost 2 years and grown the company from around 30 employees to just under 200 employees. And I've done everything in the realm of recruiting and benefits, compensation, staffing, all under the side of the people function. And been at big companies such as Google, SanDisk, and small startups such as Peep.com and currently Pura, which is also a startup. I'm also a mom of two cute little kids and a wife as well. So those take up a lot of my time too.
And Pura, as you were explaining before we started, this is super cool. If you want to explain it.
Oh, yes. So Pura is a smart home fragrance diffuser device. So you can buy an electronic device that plugs into your wall outlet and scents your home. So it's an alternative for a candle, not a replacement, but we partner with brands that are known and loved, such as Capri Blue Volcano, Disney, Tommy Bahama, lots of cool brands to get those scents that you love into your home. And truth be told, coming up soon into your car. So that'll be fun.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brittany. I oversee the people ops function at The Block Crypto, which is a digital asset information company. So we are providing news and research on what's going on in the crypto digital asset space, which is a lot every day, but exciting work to be doing. We similarly have grown really quickly. I've only been with the company for 8 months, and we went from 40 to 140 in that time and are continuing to grow. I think we have 60 open positions today. A lot of interesting stuff happening behind the scenes there, but this is my third startup that I have worked at. Love the startup space. I've also worked at larger companies. I did a stint with Google, worked at a publishing company called ALM prior to this, but got my start in recruiting and now enjoy the broader people ops space.
And hi, everybody. I'm Maggie Duvall. I lead recruiting at VHO, and VHO is a tech-powered logistics platform that is aiming to humanize logistics by putting the customer at the center of every delivery. And VHO raised a huge Series B back in February. And with that, we've been expanding geographically and expanding our employee base pretty drastically over the last year, too. I've been with VHO coming up on a year now, and we've grown the company from about 200 employees to about 850 today. So tons and tons of hiring going on over at VHO. And prior to VHO, I was at Uber for 5.5 years. And part of the team that helped the company grow from 5,000 to 25,000 globally. So love working at super hyper growth companies, helping them build the companies and find the right people.
Awesome. Nice to meet all of you, Cassidy, Maggie, and Brittany. So obviously there's a lot in the news right now coming from VCs about the looming recession, cutbacks, how companies should react. And a lot of employees probably have a lot of questions on what does that mean for them? What does that mean for recruiting as a whole as well and hiring more folks? And I don't know if any of you have been a part of those discussions with your broader team and how you've responded and overall, just how you responded to that, because obviously it could be pretty confusing for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in here. So operating the crypto space, I think there is a lot of volatility in it regardless. And that's been the trend that we've dealt with since it really launched. I think from a people leader's perspective, what I've really been focused on is making sure that the leadership team has been as transparent as they possibly can with the rest of the company. We, like everybody else, especially in the crypto space, have been impacted in a negative way. But we had our CEO send a note about this about 2 weeks ago to the entire company that just said, we're monitoring it. These are the different ways that we're monitoring it. We have been adjusting our business model over the last 18 months. Talking about how we have plenty of runway to survive it, and we will be looking at costs and making sure that we're spending in the right ways. But I think the worst thing that you can do is nothing. I feel like it breeds a culture of gossip that doesn't end up being productive for anyone. So as much of the message as you can own and get in front of, that has been my big thing that I've been pushing the leadership on. And I think we've had success there so far.
Yeah, I'll echo that same thing. The transparency, I think, is the biggest key to keeping things from not falling apart. And one thing with that transparency is remembering who your audience is. So when you're working with your senior leadership team, you can talk very transparently about everything that's going on. Everyone understands. When you're sharing that with a bottom line employee, that's the frontline employee that's doing their first job, their first time out of maybe college in their first career and don't really understand how maybe finances work or whatever it is, to make sure that you are explaining things so they understand the why for every decision that you're making as we prep for this recession and what's to come. So whether that's, we're not going to do snacks in the office anymore, you can't just take that away and expect that no one has questions, but really showing this one tiny thing actually saves a lot of money on the back end to repurpose that money here, and making sure you're almost like hand-holding every step and not just assuming that all employees understand financial models and runways and cash flow and things like that.
And chiming in from a hiring specific angle, I think something that we have been talking about a lot here at VHO specifically is, what impacts might a recession have on like our growth in revenue, and how should we realign our hiring to like make sure that it's aligned with this like reforecasted financial plan to make sure that we don't overhire? And so being really thoughtful about that is super important, and honestly, one that's going to set one startup apart from others headed into this. And then I think also, like Brittany and Cassie also just touched on this too, but like, where are there appropriate cost savings with a change in the market? And like, we're coming from one of the hottest job markets that we have all seen in quite some time, and that is changing rather rapidly. Has your company historically been offering a number of hiring incentives? Are those needed anymore with the market shifting, and reevaluating those to see, are there areas for cost saving for your company based on the changing trends we're seeing?
That's super interesting. And Cassidy, you brought up a lot of great points of being, everyone's going to have a different level of understanding about the broader macroeconomic impacts and et cetera. Now, do you feel it's best to sit people down one-on-one and walk them through whatever their questions are, or maybe have one like overarching document that can speak to even the most minute of details? Like, how best do you educate people at wider varieties of knowledge?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it really comes down to how well your people and what your people need. Some companies might find that they need to have individual one-on-ones with every employee. And some teams could say, we're going to have a big group meeting and discuss this once and call it good. But really, I would say best practice is to try to hit all forms of learning. So yes, you should have a full document people can reference to. You should have a team meeting about this. You should have smaller team meetings about this. Maybe this topic should be added to a manager's one-on-one for every check-in they do. The more angles that you can hit and make sure that they know that as a company, we want to make sure our employees are taken care of and supported through this turbulent times, whatever lies ahead. The more you can hit, I think the better it is. But also it comes down to knowing your people and knowing how that your people respond, address them in the way that they need to be addressed.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Like different strokes for some like different folks in terms of companies. But I did like your idea of maybe smaller groups, because it could be time consuming and difficult to speak to everyone one-on-one, but maybe just like a 10-person group, especially if you have hundreds of employees, and then make that like a 15-20-minute session to answer questions. And has that been somewhat successful? Or I don't know, were there any anecdote of things that you tried and have seen success or less than successes?
Yeah, in our company, we do a weekly town hall. So we address things in town hall as a company. And then we also direct leadership teams to go and then direct it to their teams. We naturally split into team groups as each team has their own team meeting to be able to keep that communication there and really just help people focus that we're all doubling down our employees to get through this together. And it's all like keeping that positive spin to such a doom and gloom situation, right? You don't want everyone to spin their own story or things like that. So really controlling that talk track to help people just band together and get through it.
Yeah. One thing that we've been doing too that I found has been helpful is going to the manager group first. Like the managers are the people who know their team the best, and they know what kind of questions their team are going to have or how they're going to react. So usually when we're thinking about this is a message that we're going to get out to the entire company, we'll talk to the manager group about that first. And a lot of times they'll provide good insight that we weren't able to think about as a leadership team because we are just naturally more removed. And almost every situation that we've done that with, we've altered our message in one way or another, or like Cassidy said, broken into smaller groups or sent different messages because people were going to interpret it in different ways.
Makes sense. Thanks for that.
One thing I think to add too is that the quicker you can respond, the more control you can have of a situation. So I think that it was mentioned earlier, but to do nothing is probably the worst thing we can do. But to do something very quickly, I think is the best. That the second you hear maybe a rumor starting or whatever it may be, just like try to get in front of those messages and be proactive more about what our communication and our transparency is going to be. So you're not behind the times and trying to also correct messes that are occurring when you could have been proactive in the first place.
Yeah. And even if you don't have all the answers, I feel like saying that you don't have all the answers, but we're talking about it and all of that is important. I feel like a lot of leadership teams get paralyzed by, we don't want to tell them before we know what's going on. But those 2 weeks that you're trying to figure out what's going on are really critical for your culture and for how people feel about the company.
That's a really great point. Yeah. Even if you don't know the answer, you can still just say that. Or I think, yeah, it is easier to just say, let's wait till we have all the facts. Things move so quickly and the facts are pretty difficult to even know. Like, what is an actual fact when you're thinking about everything macroeconomically and VCs screaming from the top of their lungs and everything like that? It's hard to really discern. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. Cool. We'll jump to the next question. This is a really great one, especially since all of you seem to have been or are in companies that are scaling really rapidly. So how do you maintain strong cultural values when you're scaling from 100 people to 500 people? Are the systems you use to spread those values a little bit different? Do the values change a little bit?
Yeah, I would love to chime in on this one. VHO, I think, really prides itself in being a very values-driven company. And I can't stress enough that scaling your values over time, there has to be tops-down investment. And I think that's something that VHO has done very well. VHO's two co-founders felt very strongly about the company values, and they referenced the values in their decision-making. They reference the values in a bunch of meetings and structural things that are company-wide. And so I think the top-down investment in those values really helps define that this is still something that is really important over time. But then additionally, like on the people side, I think it is up to us and the people organization to bring those values to life throughout the whole entire employee journey. And that actually starts with the recruiting. And so are your values in your job descriptions? Are your values referenced in the interview process? Are your values referenced when they get a job offer in writing? And then are they ingrained in onboarding and in things in the employee cycle as well? So I think that's where the people function really comes in, that like taking the tops down vision and those values that you want to grow the company around and building those into the employee life cycle and journey too.
Yeah, I would say much of the same. Integrate it into everything that you do. If there's like a program that you have, I would ask the question of like, how are our values being reflected here? Because when you go from a small number of people who everybody knows them, it's like, how do you educate a large number of humans on not only what they are, but what they mean and how we expect people to live by them? So we use them in praise, our praise tool. We use them when we give feedback to people, both constructive and positive feedback. We have a whole session actually literally right before I joined this. I did our once a month cohort training on our mission and values. So that's one of the first things that they get when they join. Career development, like we evaluate people against our values as we think about promotions. We train on values specific type of behaviors and ways that people can continue to develop their skill set in that way. But I think going back to Maggie's point, the interview process, I think if you think about how do you actually scale your culture and how do you maintain that culture and those values and bring more people into the organization, you have to figure out how to evaluate for them during the interview process. And I've done that a couple of different ways at different organizations, but I think that's an important part of that too. What questions are you asking that are mapped back to your values? Are we like having conversations if we're concerned that people aren't responding to our values in the way that we want them to? Because that's usually going to be a longer term issue. And speaking of longer term issues, I think another big thing, and this goes back to leadership alignment, is you have to have a no tolerance policy for people who are not living up to your values. I feel like if you're not willing to address those issues immediately, then those values are not going to be as impactful as you want them to be if people in the organization see that you don't hold everybody accountable to them. And so I think that's the hard part about values is getting the leadership team aligned on that and having that kind of no tolerance policy.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that. And are there any like specific values that you've seen? Okay, this is something where we've noticed this employee or that team member or this person who's interviewing with us does not match this cultural value. And therefore, we either have to have a conversation with that or figure something else out. Is there something that sort of pops up over and over again?
So one of our values, we actually do key behaviors, I guess more terms than they are words, but one of them is actionable curiosity. And it's really this concept of we expect everybody in the company to be curious about their job, the industry that they're in. And then it's not enough to just be curious about that, just to like, be reading articles. It's how are you bringing that action into the organization? I would say that's probably the hardest one to evaluate for and that people struggle with the most is what's something that you were curious about that you were able to take action on, bring into the organization, your organization, and what came as a result of that. So sometimes it's just like really trying to understand how people would do in scenarios like that. A lot of times people weren't given the opportunity to have that type of environment where they could really like make recommendations and implement change at the speed in which we expect people to. But I would say that's the one that we a lot of times have to ask some follow-up questions and different questions around because sometimes people just haven't been in that environment.
They've been in like more better safe than sorry kind of environments where
exactly.
People want to speak up.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that.
And one thing I will add here to people maybe listening that are with smaller companies is to think of the scale while you're creating your values. I think that oftentimes, even when I joined Pura, we actually had a different set of core values. And about a year in, we redid our core values because we didn't actually thoughtfully think about it for scale. So when I came in, I was like, okay, how are we going to actually live these same values when we're at 200, 300, 400, 500 employees, whatever it may be? We really looked at who we had become and redesigned those values so they were built for scale. So just something to keep in mind as companies are maybe at a lower level stage is to think of that scale because oftentimes they're just thinking, okay, who do we want to be? It could be different than who you want to be down the line. So try to make those values that could encompass both areas of the spectrum.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's actually planning for the fact that, hey, we're going to explode one day. And so we want to be like 6 or 12 months ahead of it. I like that. That's very wishful thinking, but clearly it worked out.
Regardless if you actually do scale though, you're already in that mindset of, okay, how are we going to embed such strong cultural values regardless of what size we are and get you to be really thoughtful what those values should be.
Okay. And was there any additional values that you added in for basically, hey, if or when we get to this size, this is an addition that we need to add in versus right now with this smaller size, it may not be as impactful.
Yeah, I could see that happening. We actually decreased values. So we had 5 when I started and we actually went down to 4. And one of our core values is simple. Like how can we get these complex ideas and thoughts and processes and how can we always make sure when our value is to keep things simple? So it just was interesting to see how we morphed and our values are human, uplifting, remarkable, and simple. So just these words that we can really tie in and build upon and have those culture ads as we bring more and more people, they can usually all find something to relate under those values. So it's become very scalable. But yeah, it's just an interesting thing about how our values might not have been as easy to scale. I think that everything can be scaled if we're thoughtful about it, but that we just really took a step back. We're like, let's just make this simple so we can scale it better.
That makes sense. Thanks for that. What do you think is coming down the pipe in the next few years? How is everything that all three of you are working on going to evolve? And how are you able to separate the signal from the noise? Obviously, there's a lot of new tech that comes out. There's a lot of new books that people come out with that say that they have a new approach to what everyone is doing in terms of HR, people leadership, creating cultures. So how do you wade through all of that noise and figure out what you want to do for the next few years? And are there going to be new trends that have come up from either from new research or learnings or et cetera that you found that are interesting?
I'd say I'm happy to chime in. Like a few things come to mind. One thing that I think has changed in the field of people in HR that is certainly here to stay is like historically HR has been seen as like very much a softer skills department. Those skills are still very important, but we have definitely evolved to put more emphasis on like quantitative measures of the people function. And I think that 100% is here to stay to be able to like quantitatively really help prove the value that you're bringing to the organization. I think additionally, and I know there were a ton of questions around this space that we'll get to, COVID and what it brought with remote work and how you build cultures in a remote setting. Like that's a huge challenge that I think has yet to be solved by a lot of different companies. And that's something that's like very much top of mind. And then last but not least, the emphasis and importance of diversity and inclusion, not only in who you're bringing to the organization, but also who you are retaining and growing within the organization. I think that's a really important thing that is here to stay that a lot of companies are like digging into deeper, creating some programs around. So those are the things that come to mind for me. Would be curious what Cassie and Brittany think about those too.
Yeah, I agree with all of those. And I think if the last 2 years have taught us anything in this space, it's that you have to be prepared for the unknown So I know this isn't totally the question, but the thing that I've really realized over the last couple of years as we've gone through all of this change in the people space is that the kind of most critical thing that you can do as a people ops professional is find a network of people. And the reason that I say that is there aren't really proven playbooks on how to handle DEI or what the right remote working culture is for your team. But there are other people in the trenches every day who are also trying to figure this stuff out, who have experimented, who have failed, who have succeeded. And that's been like my approach to all of this stuff is really just trying to find other people who have gone through it similar. The other thing, Maggie mentioned this a little bit, but the people analytics part is something that I've been leaning into the last couple of months really heavily, because I do think that is going to be something that we continue to need to build and expand on. And I think we all know that measuring the people sentiment can be difficult. I think there are ways to do that, but there's always a people element there. So I think that will be something that we'll all continue to try to figure out over the next few years, honestly. And what can we measure? What is the most effective? What does that data tell us is going to be an important thing that we're all trying to navigate, or I certainly am at least.
And the second half of this question that's around how do you thoughtfully adapt? One thing that I always make sure to do is to put myself in my employee's shoes. I'm sure we all do this, but there can be so much that we learn or read about or try this or try that. Like you mentioned, the new leadership books or a new podcast saying this. And it's exciting to just take this and say, oh, I want to go and implement this here at my company. But if you put yourself in your employee's shoes, you don't want to cause like this whiplash. You want to be a stable source for them. They're relying on us as the people function to get through wherever we're headed. And whether that's ups or downs or whatever, they're relying on the people function to be the source of stability. And so I think it's important that we should adapt. We should take what's good and we should try new things. And we should be flexible to implement what's coming and be able to do that. But in a way that we're not changing course every 2 days or whatever it may be, like just remembering that employee perspective and make sure that we're really being very thoughtful before we go and implement something. And so sometimes that is saying with the COVID stuff and maybe we don't know the answer yet, we're going to work through this and we don't want to take action yet, but having that transparency where it could be actually we need to take this action, but maybe let's just because we heard an article that someone else did it different, we don't need to hurry and switch over to what they're doing. Let's really be thoughtful to make sure that we're not causing this instability with our employees when they're relying on us for that. But again, to be open about it, because I do think that as we evolve, we will all learn and grow. And like Brittany said, rely on your network to see what is working for people and to be brave enough to try new things in your company, but just be very thoughtful about it. So again, we're not creating an unstable environment.
Good time to do another values check too, when you're implementing new things. Why am I trying to implement this? What is this going to do for us? Is this aligned with the culture that we have here and the values that we say that we care about? I feel like you can always gut check it to those things.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like a lot of the future of the evolution of people leadership, what a lot of you're mentioning, is being a lot more data driven. And it'll turn into a little bit more of a science as it continues onward. Are there certain metrics that you've been tracking within your organization to test the health of culture and maybe even test the health of new efforts that you've been trying to understand? Was this the right effort? Should we pull it back? Anything like that?
Yeah. So I think data tells a story. We do track different things, but we always try to look for the story behind the data, because I think it's really easy to say, we just went through an engagement survey, for example. And I know that's one thing that leaders use a lot, like how engaged is our team? But just because your engagement score went from 80% positivity to 85% positivity, there's a lot of other things that changed on the back end of that score that you also have to take into consideration. When you think about this 6-month honeymoon period of most of the time, people are going to give only positive feedback in that first 6 months. After that, they're likely to drop off. So in the same way, if you just onboarded 100 people and then your growth slows down and your engagement score goes from 85 to 80, it's not necessarily, you have to look at all the things that go into that. And I think that's the real challenge with the people space. We've even we track time to fill, time to close. And those are important things at growing organizations, as I'm sure Maggie and Cassidy both know. But there's a story there too. We're in a different market now. We were hiring 10 of the same positions and that kind of skewed our numbers from the quarter prior to this quarter. So it's always, there are things that we're measuring, but that's what I feel like I haven't figured out yet is how do you use that information when it is a people-driven space and you're dealing with humans and not computers?
At Pura, there's a lot of quantitative metrics that Brittany just mentioned, but a lot of the people data is also can be the qualitative data. So we have gone through every single one of our employees and done what we call a stay interview. I'm sure that other companies have done this as well. But instead of an exit interview, like instead of you're on the way out the door and I want to know how your experience is, we do a stay interview and ask how that experience is going so that every individual has that one-on-one meeting to be able to voice how they're feeling and how they're engaged and actually really sort through that qualitative data to be able to see where maybe our gaps are that we can fix so that we're not having our turnover go through the roof or anything like that.
That's really interesting. So a stay interview might be like once a year with someone, or how best do you think about the interval with that?
Yeah, right now we just did everyone this quarter and we plan to probably do it every 6 months actually to keep tabs on where people are at.
That's really helpful. Okay. I've actually never heard of a stay interview before. That's really great to take. Cool. I think a lot of what all three of you are mentioning is how to keep the broader base of your employees that are not executives engaged, excited, make sure they're heard. What about providing value to executives within the organization? Is it a little bit of a different function? Is the way you do it a little bit different? Yeah, would love to hear any sort of thoughts or anecdotes or feedback there.
One thing that I think is important, just like I was mentioned before, when we have to have that transparency and really walk people through on the front line that maybe don't understand the finances that the execs are reviewing. For that executive team, you can go to your executive team and have to walk through maybe what a frontline employee is feeling. You're almost the voice for all of your employees to your executive team. And so making sure that the value is there where you're helping them be the eyes and ears within their business so they can actually see where those holes are. So even like with this, with these stay interviews that we're doing, we are reporting back into our executive team. So they're very much aware of what teams could use some extra guidance or coaching, or what teams could use some more knowledge around where we're headed and why we're doing it that way, or whatever they may be. You're almost that puzzle builder to put all the pieces together. And so that can be a good value for the execs, is that just like you're going to walk through at a certain level for your employees, you're going to do that right back to your executives and make sure they understand what key pieces are fitting where and how the big puzzle comes together.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. Executives are not exempt from all the same processes of everyone else.
Yeah. And one thing that I do too is I meet with all of our executives every month for an hour. And I'm a big fan of not having 1 hour meetings. I think most things can be done in 45 minutes, but I do an hour with executives every month. And the goal there is to stay really close to just what's happening on their teams. What I found to be most effective is coming with an agenda, asking them really specific questions. Who on your team is performing really well? Who on your team needs help? As an example, and the agendas will change up every month, but I'll send them the agenda like 48 hours in advance so that they're prepared for those conversations. And I find that I learn a lot about what's going on within their teams that they're thinking about, but they're not thinking about at the level of vocalizing it. And so it gives me an opportunity to be more of a strategic partner with them to figure that situation out, rather than have them come to me when it's like a true HR problem in their mind. Like, managers love to do this. Like, this person isn't doing well. I need to do something about it. And it's like, what have you done about it to date? And the answer is usually nothing. So just getting on the inside of that and like understanding where their mind's at and how they're thinking about their team and where they need more help. I think that kind of helps us as people to build that trust with the executive team to make decisions, especially strategic ones, when you need to, because they've seen you help them solve problems before within their teams.
Yeah. That's interesting. And it's interesting that you bring up a point of when there's an issue, but that someone does not want to vocalize it, but you have to like pry a little bit there to get that out of them. That's interesting. And you find that when you have those meetings, you are able to get to that a little bit quicker, where previously someone would just wait till it's almost blown up.
Yeah. And it's funny, I a lot of times see like little light bulbs go off in people's heads. Oh, this is an issue. I should be talking about this sooner. Or even if it's not an issue, we're working on training all of our managers right now on best practices around remote management. So last month I spent 10 minutes of those conversations saying, what are you struggling with the most in managing your team remotely? And so being able to just get some insight into what's going on those teams so that we can deliver training to managers that is actually going to be helpful based on what we're hearing from the leadership team. You can use those in so many ways, but it really helps me prioritize my time and strategy in the month ahead to make sure that I basically view my role as making sure that the leadership team is operating at like full capacity. So what can I be doing to help make sure that that's happening?
That's really helpful.
And so one additional point on this question, specifically from a hiring angle, and something that we have seen quite a bit at a company that is growing so rapidly, is the value that recruiting can bring to executives as well as hiring managers, and just like purely doing a very thorough scoping of a job before you post the job and start the recruiting process. And I think something that oftentimes needs to be fleshed out in that conversation is, what is the skill set that you need today? But more importantly, what is the skill set you're going to need a year from now? Because at the hyper growth companies that we're all at, the role as it exists today is going to be very different than the role and person you're going to need a year from now. So helping the executives think through that like forward looking plan to make sure that you're hiring the person that's going to scale with the company. And so I think that's something that I've seen a ton of at like these hyper growth companies, that like the recruiting function can really bring a ton of values to executives as well as even lower level hiring managers too.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that. Going back to that question of metrics, outside of just how well is the company doing as a whole, if you are sitting down with the executives once a month and talking about everything related to the team below them, are there certain metrics that you also try to share with them in those meetings to say, hey, by the way, here's where you are on this particular kind of rubric. Here's where you were the previous month. Yeah, what are some good metrics to potentially start tracking with people at various levels within your organization?
I don't know if anybody have this. We don't have a dashboard where we're like, we haven't built that out yet. We should get there. It's on the roadmap, but we're not there yet. But usually I'll go into those meetings with one metric because people just love metrics. So it's either, this is how many positions you had available over the last quarter. This is how many we filled on time. This is the budget. We'll talk about recruiting. One thing that I've been leaning into lately, and I just tried this in the last two of these, and I'm going to continue to do it, is trying to give them a sense of how much PTO their team is taking. I feel like that has become a kind of hot topic in the people space. It's like work-life balance, not being able to separate, especially when we're all working remotely and from home, people not taking time off. I only had two conversations about that, but that has been eye-opening for both of those leaders to just see that their teams are trending towards taking like a total of 2 weeks off in this year. We're almost halfway through the year at this point. And so I think that's sparking some good conversations with them, with their teams, which is hopefully appreciated to get your leader to recommend that you take time off.
That's interesting. Thanks for that.
One like recruiting specific metric that I think is actually reflective, like not only in the recruiting team, but also from like more broad, like leadership performance and effectiveness, is like the accept rates of candidates for the company. Because I think this is reflective of how understood is the tops down vision and potential of the company. Like, how is that being communicated to internally to hiring managers and recruiters to be able to be explained to candidates? How is the marketing of the company and the future of the company? Like, how's that going? And I think that actually is often a metric that is like directly tied to recruiting, but I would argue that's a metric that really should be owned by more than just the recruiting organization and is a reflection on like leadership as a whole.
I love that. One thing I was going to share is that we use Gallup's 12 engagement questions as our quarterly survey. And those questions are pretty straightforward around, do you have the materials to do your work? Do you have discussions about your career development? Have you done what you do best every day? Like things like that. But really, we actually break it down as anonymous as we can with still getting enough data that we can determine which leaders are more effective than other leaders. So based off those scores, we can break it out and realize that, okay, our support team is all scored very high in these three areas. So their leader might not need to work on this area. Whereas our product management team, they're scoring really high in these other areas. So we know that leader needs to work on this area. And we have our business partners sit down with each leader to show where they can be more effective amongst those 12 questions. So that's just something that Pura does to be able to try to pinpoint the effectiveness across different leaders, because different orgs have different strengths and their weaknesses. So it points to where we need to work on.
We do something similar to that too. And you can see heat maps, and we talk about it actually at the leadership level. We look at all the results and all the different teams. And a lot of times that sparks some good conversation around, oh, we're trying this, and maybe that's driving these positive results, and other managers or leaders can take those recommendations. But yeah, I agree with that. And people love to see that.
As we dive in each quarter, where we talk about, okay, go work on this, the very next quarter, it's also gone way up. But then what was necessarily a strength last time is now a weakness, because they always tend to focus on certain areas. So it's the balance of, you got to focus on all of them, not high scores in all ranks. But yeah, they love knowing how they're ranking and where they can work on. So really having those metrics to provide them is a great tool.
Yeah. And if a team or a leader of a team is noticing they're a little bit low on some of those metrics, have you noticed it being a good kind of like change tool so that they build up a better culture for the folks who are reporting in?
Absolutely. Yeah, Brittany probably gets to do this too. But when we call someone out on, and it's those questions are pretty broad. So it's actually cool to take the team and say, hey, your team is not feeling like they have the tools to do their work. And the manager says, oh, that's actually because half of their computers are failing. And I'm like, let's fix their computers. An issue would I have. But because we brought them a broad question, the manager helped us pinpoint the actual issue. So it's been really cool to see all that happen.
Yeah, our team is really competitive. It's been helpful. And even like to get people to do the surveys, we'll send it out to the leadership team and say, the engineering team is at 90% and the marketing team is at 80%. And then the marketing leader will go back to their organization. So it's like, we just have a good kind of competitive nature. And so people really want to get those scores up.
That's awesome. Hopefully the marketing leader in that scenario is not bribing their team to give them better scores, but
wait on the data.
It's all anonymous.
Yeah. How has remote work and the move to remote work changed your culture and how have you responded to that? Are there new functions that you put in so that people feel a little more drawn to the overall culture, even if they're not sitting in the same office? Are you doing more of a hybrid thing these days? I think everyone's had to adjust to this, probably has had a lot of anecdotes and learnings from that. So we'll have any insights.
I can start. So we are a remote first company. So we have people globally everywhere. I would say the vast majority of our team works remotely. And I think a lot of this was determined right when I joined. We were in this big hiring push and we needed to figure out what is the best way that we're going to be able to meet those goals. And we leaned into knowing if we can hire people from anywhere, we're going to get there a lot faster. It's also really helped with the diversity of our team. So I think ultimately for our company, it was the right decision. I know that every company has different expectations and measures of success and things like that, but that's what we leaned into. So we do have an office in New York. We have at most, like some of the most busy days in the office, well, like 12 or 13 people in there. We have hosted some events in the New York office to try to get people engaged and wanting to come in, but we don't spend a lot of time. Like I know some companies are like, we have to make Wednesdays the most exciting day of the week so that everybody wants to come in and everybody wants to work together. And we haven't really taken that approach. What we did is we tried to be really honest about when we rolled this out. We know that there are challenges that come with this. We know that communication is going to be difficult in a remote environment where we have people globally. We know it's going to be hard to create connections with your team in a way that you have the ability to do in an office that you no longer will, or the majority of us no longer will. But ultimately, we think the ability to recruit and to create a more diverse team all outweigh the challenges that we're going to face. And basically what we did is we leaned into those things that we knew were going to be challenges over the course of this year. And that those have been big focus areas for the company and for the people team. So we like standardized how we communicate. We've been really prescriptive about what a Slack message is for, what an email is for, what when to hold a meeting, when not to hold a meeting. We just worked on rolling out expectations around global collaboration. Our team naturally is going to get emails and Slack messages outside of their standard work hours. And so we were really explicit about if you need a response, then this is how you frame that. And you're just really clear about it. It's working for us. I think there's always going to be things that can be better. And I think it's something we're going to be working on for the foreseeable future. But I think the team's been happy with it. And I think it's been helping with us able to recruit as quickly as we have been able to. So yeah, we're working on it, but I think happy with it right now.
It sounds like the pros outweigh the drawbacks for remote work for you thus far.
Yep.
Great. Maggie or Cassidy, any sort of learnings over the last few years in terms of remote and how are your sort of environments structured currently?
At VHO, it's interesting because by nature of our business, 40% of our teammate population, their job requires them to physically be located in our warehouses, sorting and distributing packages into the cars of VHO's driver partners. And 40% of our workforce, consequently, does have to physically show up to a location. And then the other 60% are able to do their jobs remotely. And VHO really took off during the pandemic. So for the 60% of the population that is able to work remote, the company hasn't known any different. But it's interesting as we are starting to kind of like transition, hopefully out of the pandemic or on the other side, the questions have started coming up, like what's the long-term vision and plan here? And I think the things that we're actively starting to think through and get like our overall like strategy and approach on is where are the locations where we want to commit to having physical real estate and allowing people the option to come in if they want? And why are we choosing those locations, as well as what is the budget and the resources given to each team leader to get their remote employees together on a regular cadence? And this is something that's like very top of mind for me, because we had our first recruiting team get together just a week ago. And it's a significant investment to do that on a regular cadence. And I think companies, like if they're committed to the remote, like making some sort of an investment to allow leaders to be able to do that for their teams. But there is like an honest like monetary as well as time commitment in doing that well.
It's interesting to see all the differences of each company. Our company is actually majority is in office. We have a remote workforce, probably about maybe 20% is remote. And so us being mostly in office, it's been a challenge, just like as Brittany was mentioning, the flip sides of what she's dealing with. I'm getting the other ones. Like it's harder for us to hit our diversity and inclusion goals sometimes because we're dealing with only our subset of people here locally. But it's been fun to tackle those challenges and really think, okay, what is our strategy going to be able to relocate people so they can be in office when that's not a popular thing right now? It's hard to convince employees to move when the norm right now is they can work remote. So be able to bridge that and know like, when is it good for this role to be in person in the office and have that camaraderie and that team building and that close connection to get things done, and when a role is completely okay to be remote. We basically have to take it case by case and figure out, okay, this is a crucial role to be on site versus this is a crucial role that can happen elsewhere. And I think similar to Maggie, we have a few people that have to be on site due to the nature of their work. We're building prototypes of our devices right here on site. So to have all the equipment and things they need, they don't have to be here. So it's an interesting dynamic to navigate when we have multiple people in multiple locations. But just like Brittany was saying, it's important to communicate, okay, how do we address Slack messages? What's the response time on Slack? And what are your out of office icons if you're not available right then? Or what are your typical meeting hours? So we just went through and set all those structures up and made sure that, okay, meetings should happen during these hours so that everyone can attend, or meetings should not occur on these days. Like we just implemented that no meetings on Fridays so we could help people get that work as not only here in person, but also remote wherever they may be.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that. And yeah, it's interesting from our end. Obviously, we interview a lot of executives who are geographically dispersed, and a majority say they're particularly looking for remote first roles. However, we're getting more and more people who are getting a little sick of it and want to be in an office. I'll say it's, from a numbers perspective, way smaller than people who are looking for remote, but also living in New York is such a start off your career in New York City, have all your these like happy hour friends. It's such a great city for someone to start off the early portion of their career and have this fun, like after work culture. And I think that's something a lot of people who are starting off their career, particularly the ones who are moving to New York for that, really look forward to. And I think want a little bit more of that. So some of those cultures who are able to nurture that locally can be pretty fun for some folks. So we'll see. I'm very curious to see if over the next 6 to 12 months, more and more candidates raise their hand and say this remote thing is great, but I actually like sitting with my coworkers and I want to be able to go and grab lunch with them and do basic like in-person things like that. And whether hybrid is good enough for that, to be able to go in once a week and occasionally see some folks, or something a little bit more deep. Are there any virtual kind of culture building things that have been helpful, or Zoom happy hours aren't necessarily cutting it?
Yeah, I think they're not cutting it. And I will say, just to piggyback off of that, like, yes, we implemented this remote first thing, and I think it was successful for us. We do have people during the offer stage that ask a lot of questions about the office. Do people go into the office? And we are in New York. So we, especially when we have candidates in New York, a lot of times they want an office in a different way than other geographical locations do. You know, I certainly don't have space in my New York City apartment to have an office, and I don't think a lot of people do. So we are trying to navigate that, and we're in the process of getting a new office actually to accommodate some of that. So we just have a little bit of a better space that people hopefully want to utilize. But yeah, that is a challenge, but we're working on it. In terms of remote events, if anybody has figured this out, I would love you to try to book on it, because appealing to everyone for a remote event is what I've realized is not possible. So I've stopped trying to do that. And so we're still having them, but they're very much focused in like smaller group settings. Like, first of all, nobody wants to be on a virtual happy hour, really any virtual event with 100 people. You're never going to get a word in. Like, that's just not good team building. We've created Slack channels that are more kind of interest-based. And then we've been creating events within those interests so that people can choose to come to things as they wish and as it's relatable to them. But the other thing that I would say that we've leaned into that has been pretty successful is asking other people in the company. You always have those people who are just kind of like your culture ads. Like they come to everything. They're like really excited about the culture and they are just like good participants. We've had them create some events and given them kind of a small budget to do it. And a lot of times when it's coming from internal and not from the people team, I feel like they're more well attended, or there's some sort of sales team is putting this on. And so everybody on the sales team wants to be there to support the sales team. So that's what I would recommend if you're hitting a rut in virtual events. Now, the one last thing actually I'll add to that is we've done a variety of different things, both like in-house led events and then external vendors. Again, we're really competitive. We had a really good turnout to a trivia event that we did. And then we were able to do one session of it, one part of it that was block trivia. So people showed up and really wanted to show their block knowledge. But a lot of the most successful ones have been the things that people put on that were built internally and cost no money. We did one that was like a work from home cribs where everybody submitted a picture of their at home setup. And then people had to guess what it was. And people got so into it because most people see the behind version of your home office, but not the like actual desk that you work out of. And people just got such a kick out of that. And it was free. So it just depends. You have to play around with it and see what works. But I don't think it's one of those things you have to drop a bunch of money on to try to fix either.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I think people on our team have gotten really good at creating trivia games, but we have very different functions considering we're 60 people and some of you are approaching 1,000. So yeah, it's a little bit different.
I definitely agree with Brittany's point around it is like everyone's responsibility, and they're like much more successful when you bring others into the ownership of facilitating the events. It's not company-wide, but someone brought this to our team and we're so thankful that she did, but someone took on the responsibility of doing a get to know your teammate post every other week where they do a quick fun fact survey and then you post the answers to those and everyone gets to know that employee a little bit more. And or biweekly team meeting is hosted by another member of the team every single week. And at the end, they do like a fun session that's like a 5-minute session. And I think everyone is generally more excited to go to see what that person will choose to do, as well as like super respectful and engaged to be respectful of the person who is like owning and presenting it that time. So I just think like crowdsourcing it and getting others involved is a really great point that I agree with.
I like that. Let everyone use their own unique creativity and knowledge of their own friends and teams that they interact with daily to know what they might be in. We talked about remote teams quite a bit. And are there any additional kind of tips that you've noticed have worked well for managers and all of you to help manage remote teams?
One thing that we made sure all employees hear, because we have majority in office, we really reinforced to not forget about the remote team members. Because when we're walking to the meeting, say we have a room booked and 8 of the 10 of us are walking to that room, no one's quite in there to turn the meeting on. So we have 2 employees now sitting in the remote work locations wondering, is this meeting still happening? Are they late? Am I late? What's going on? In the state of confusion, when really there was just this group that started talking, not about the meeting itself, but we're just in this environment, everyone's together and chit-chatting and having that quick meeting camaraderie beforehand and not realizing that these team members are so in the dark. So we were very cognizant to say, everyone, you need to be on time to meeting and start the meeting first thing to make sure that no remote employee is just left in the dark. And even for people that work from home, every once in a while, like I come to the office 4 days a week and work one day at home, it's the same for them. They're now in the dark. They're not getting this like what's happening. So just one thing to be really effective for managers too is to make sure that they are enforcing that with their teams as well, so that no one is feeling just out in this remote realm that's not there. And then also to make sure that your managers that are managing remote teams are trained to do that. So I think that it was Brittany that mentioned that they're doing trainings on remote teams. I don't think we just expect that our people know how to do this, especially as it's become more and more normal. There's a lot more research, and really give that training to them so they can have the tools they need to, and they're not just left to their own devices to make it work.
Yeah. And we created what we call management pods, which we're taking those smaller groups through a bunch of different trainings on all the things that we said that we were going to prioritize this year. But we created a Slack channel, and we every now and then we'll pop in and be like, hey, we have this situation. Has anybody dealt with this before? So I think empowering your managers to build relationships with each other and share their best practices as it relates to remote, or share their challenges and let them solve it themselves. That kind of goes back to the same thing I was saying earlier about networking with other people ops professionals. But like having somebody that you can go to and be like, hey, I'm dealing with this situation, like who's dealt with this before, has been really beneficial for our team. Just like making sure that you create the space for that and you set that expectation that they should utilize each other's experience, because everybody has different experiences.
A really great point. Thank you all three of you, Brittany, Cassidy, and Maggie. This has been super helpful. I think we've gotten a lot of tips and tricks on remote work, all the crazy stuff happening with the recession, how to communicate with teams as you are growing to become hundreds and hundreds of employees, and how to infuse a little bit of science and data into something that was historically thought of as not having a lot as much to it. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.